Good morning, everyone. So, this is the third talk in our series on Nehemiah, entitled Building a Faithful Community to Serve God and Our Neighbours. And we've almost reached the point where the building starts. In talk one, we heard about how Nehemiah was commissioned by God through prayer to leave Persia, where he was serving the king in exile, to go to Jerusalem and restore the city walls. And in talk two, last week, we heard about how Nehemiah planned and made preparations for this project, anticipating the challenges that lay ahead. And now, in talk three, it's all about to happen. And the question we as readers are asking ourselves about Nehemiah is exactly the same as a well-known TV children's character. Doesn't scan quite as well, but you could say, Nehemiah the Builder, can he fix it? And with God's help, yes he can. Unlike Bob, the difficulty for Nehemiah was all his planning had been from afar. He'd probably never been to Jerusalem, but certainly not since he'd been commissioned for this task. So he could not fully understand the scale of the task that awaited him, and the exact details of what needed doing. That's why in the early part of our passage today, he makes an inspection of the state of the walls of Jerusalem. Now, if it were any of us in the modern age, we'd go out in broad daylight, probably on a good day, and bring with us a group of professional experts, engineers, architects, surveyors, and scaffolders, and we'd draw up plans together. But Nehemiah didn't have that luxury. His project is controversial for some because he knows it's going to be opposed by people because it threatens their power and control. Do you remember the part about Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite in last week's reading? Well, they're actually going to feature later, but Nehemiah knows he's got opposition. So he needs to operate discreetly and keep himself under the radar, away from attention. And he does this in three ways. Once he arrives in Jerusalem, he lies low for 3 days, probably just to allow the buzz of interest to dissipate. After all, when a special visitor arrives from the empire headquarters, it's bound to attract some attention. And then when he goes on his inspection mission, he sets out at night with just a few men, and those men don't even know what they're doing there, really. He hasn't told them his plans. And as you can see in that image there, although it doesn't really show nighttime, but they've got torches lit. So possibly the torch is the best means they've got to actually have a good look at what's going on. Maybe there was moonlight as well, we're not told, but it's certainly not really a particularly great way to survey a major building project. And he is the only one to ride a mount, maybe a horse or a mule or a donkey. And that, again, is so as not to attract attention by having a great big troop of people with hooves clopping. There's a real element of stealth in how he operates. Now, when we have plans that God has laid on our hearts, sometimes it isn't easy to actually have those plans in secret. But they have to be secret because they may affect people in ways that we can't predict. As with Nehemiah, it can be perfectly clear that within the plan, there is a time and a place later on when it can be shared. But until then, you have to keep it quiet for the plan to be effective. Though any of us here who are involved in management or any position of responsibility in workplaces or in the church often carry a necessary burden of secrecy with knowing sensitive information. For example, those of you who serve on PCC will be very familiar with that. Lots of things get, you know, talked around at PCC long before they ever become established in the church. And so you kind of have that knowledge of what's coming, but you don't want to send everyone to know. And it can be very isolating if it goes on for a long time, because it's always easier to be open with people. And also, it's hard to remember the things that you're supposed to keep secret, especially as you get older. In church life, it really does help to have a close network of faithful friends who can be trusted. They could be in prayer triplets, or maybe in your home groups. But that support is part of God's provision for us. Remember how Jesus promised to take our burdens and give us rest? So the question to consider is, do you have trusted friends in St. Mark's, or maybe other Christians, who you can share burdens with? Doing this is part of building up a faithful community. Just ask yourself, are there any burdens you've brought with you this morning? Because we will have prayer ministry after this talk, and you can share them with the people who are doing the prayer ministry. All of those people have been trained and can be trusted with sensitive information. And it can be about anything, not necessarily a grand building project plan. Fortunately for Nehemiah, he can learn all he needs from his nighttime journey around the walls. Interestingly, he doesn't go around the whole city walls, just part of it. And on finishing his journey and having assessed what needs doing, he's finally reached the point where he could tell others. And the time was now right for him to reveal God's plans. And he needed to gather the right people, people whose hearts were open to being stirred by God, in the same way that Nehemiah's heart had been. And once gathered, he then needed to appeal to them in a way to engage them and earn their commitment. And he achieved this by giving a compelling testimony of what he had experienced in his exchanges with God at the start. Firstly, that visceral feeling that had brought him to tears when he first heard the news about the condition of the walls. That sense of being in disgrace, collective disgrace, that had led him to mourn and fast and seek God. Verse 17, then I said to them, you see the trouble we're in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace. It's a strong word, disgrace. And secondly, he then goes on to talk about how God had responded to him in a personal way over this. Verse 18, I told them about the gracious hand of God upon me and what the king had said to me. Testimony like this is always compelling, provided the speaker is authentic and speaks clearly and calmly of what God has said to them. In his first letter, Peter instructs us as believers to always be ready with our testimony in a well-known verse, 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15, and it's up on the screen written inside that silhouette. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect. I always find it a challenge to think about what I would say if I was just suddenly put on the spot at any moment in sort of everyday life. So I'd like us all now just to do something. I'd like you to take a moment just to reflect to yourself on what you would say if someone asks you for the reason for your hope in Jesus Christ. What is your testimony of experiencing God? So no need to share it with anyone, but just take a moment to draw on your memories and organise your thoughts. Okay, and hopefully you've thought of something. And just again, so it doesn't just drift away in a fading memory, try and capture it somehow. If you've got a pen and paper with you, just write it down. Even just two words, it's more just the trigger prompt. The rest of the story is in your head, but it's just that kind of connection, finding the file on your computer, in your brain. you've got a smartphone with you, I shan't mind if you get it out and just put it in the notes bit. But just have it ready. Have it available. Instant recall. Nehemiah's testimony is evidently very powerful because the people responded to it exactly as he had hoped. Verse 18 goes on to say, they replied, let us start rebuilding. So they began this good work. Nehemiah has been successful at what is known as casting a vision. I know that Simon is going to pick up on that point in a later talk in this series, so I'm just planting that in there now. The second part of today's reading is chapter 3, which actually goes on for a full 32 verses in a similar and rather repetitive manner, although we only heard the first 12. Richard was actually going to reduce it to 8, but I insisted on 12. I think Peter did a very valiant job kind of getting it all out there with all those difficult names. You're going to hear me stumble on a few of them later. But this whole chapter is really just one long list of those people who rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem under Nehemiah's direction, and what sections they rebuilt. At first sight, it seems quite boring, rather like reading a telephone directory crossed with an A to Z street atlas. For anyone here who's under the age of 30, they're probably not familiar with either of those things. You might have to ask an older person later. But lists like this are a feature of the books of Chronicles, Ezra, and Nehemiah, which come together in the Old Testament, covering this period of history. And the list in chapter 3 covers the sections of the wall and the gates and towers in perfect order. It goes round in a circle of the city, starting at the top, as you can see on that slide, where there's a little red thing that says start, and in the way that my big arrows have shown. You kind of go round full circle in that chapter. Every verse covers a gate and a tower. And this is really of great interest to historians and scholars, because you actually have a perfect record of what Old Jerusalem was like in Old Testament times. But I'm more interested in the people, because it reveals that there was a wholehearted response from the Jewish community of faith, albeit with some exceptions, inspired by Nehemiah's drive and vision. So if we examine these 12 verses in greater detail, there's not a lot of information there about individuals, but there are certain things that you can pull out of the text that actually help us to build the picture of what was going on. The ones that stood out for me in terms of individuals who built are firstly priests. Verse 1 tells us that Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. So those with status in the religious order, the archbishops and bishops and clergy of their day, did not consider that manual labour was below them. They led by example, showing the people that this work, God's work, was for everyone in the community, not just the labouring class. Secondly, working men, as opposed to nobles. So verse 5 tells us, the next section was repaired by the men of Tekoa, but their nobles would not put their shoulders to the work under the supervisors. This was the very opposite attitude of the priests. Tekoa was a neighbouring town, about 11 miles from Jerusalem, and their men must have actually made a journey. It wasn't even their city. So they made a journey to come over and repair it and build and rebuild a section. But their aristocratic rulers refused to do any manual labour and left it to their subordinates. Third category, professional craftsmen. Verse 8 tells us that Uzziel, son of Harhiah, one of the goldsmiths, repaired the next section, and Hananiah, one of the perfume makers, made repairs next to that. These people would be the middle-class professionals of their time. They would have given up their time when they could have been earning money for themselves in their craft business. That's sacrificial giving of their time. And, moreover, they were running the risk of injury that could have resulted in a doubt in their inability to carry on their trade, to carry on their craft and earning. Because if you think about it, handling large blocks of stone, like it shows on that image there, probably without proper lifting gear and without protective equipment, was running a pretty major risk. You could be killed, or at least just have some life-threatening injury, or damage your hand or your arm, which maybe you crafted gold with. So they were actually taking quite a risk. Political rulers. So there were two examples in this passage where we're told that local rulers carried out hands-on work. Verse 9, Raphael, son of Hur, ruler of a half-district of Jerusalem, repaired the next section. Now, there's not too much known about this, but I'd like to imagine that these people were like good local councillors, the kind of councillors that we want to have, who were working for the greater good of their constituents, rather than just in their own self-interests. And finally, and I think Peter's kind of given you a heads up on this, women. That's really important. Because again, back to that last verse, which actually talks about the other local ruler, it says, Shalom, son of Halohesh, ruler of the half-district of Jerusalem, prepared the section with the help of his daughters. So even in a patriarchal society as it was, women are specifically mentioned as contributing to the communal efforts to protect the city and the temple inside it. The whole community of faith pitched in together, following a God-given vision revealed to them through a faithful and passionate leader in Nehemiah. And it's still true today, whenever all of those things come together, there is great power and amazing things can happen. At St. Mark's, one of the best examples of how we come together as a community of faith to serve our neighbourhood is the Community Fun Day. And there are several other events like this, but the Fun Day for me is big and it's eye-catching and it stands out for the community. They can see it as they pass by. That's an image I took from over the road during the one that was a few weeks ago. And you can see that the inflatables and the barbecue gazebo, in some ways, they look a bit like city walls surrounding the church. But there were wide open gates in between, inviting people in. The Fun Day has been running continuously for many years, probably about 15. It predates Richard's arrival here. But it did have to stop during pandemic years. This year, for me, it felt like we were coming back from exile to fully serve Holbrook again. The Community Fun Day was a God-given vision for this church. And every year in recent times, it's meticulously planned with Jo Ann's oversight. Like Nehemiah, she assesses what needs to be done and makes the preparations. And then, for several weeks beforehand in church notices, we're all invited to volunteer our time and efforts to fulfill the roles that need doing. And there are many of them. Barbecue, refreshments, crafts, games. Here is this year's organisational plan. This was on the board at the back of church on the day. It lists the people who signed up in advance, but there were also plenty of volunteers on the day whose names are not here. I'm not particularly trying to show that as a role of honour. My wider point here is that all people who volunteered in that day and in events like it are wall builders. Each one has their own part in building to the success of an event that God has laid on our hearts to build his kingdom. And there are other outreach activities like children's groups and Holbrook Heart Cafe. Frequently we hear about these in notices at the end of the service, appealing for more volunteers. Sometimes that's just to sustain the activity, and sometimes it's to expand it. How many times do you hear, sign-up sheets are at the back? Speak to the church office or the vicar. Now, perhaps like many of you, when I hear these, sometimes I'm tempted to have sort of lazy thoughts like, can I be bothered? Sure, others will do it. And I don't really have the skills or experience. It's just not my thing. And sometimes, of course, and maybe often, there can be very good reasons why it doesn't work for you. But these are special opportunities for us to respond to God's call and be wall builders for his kingdom. So we should not pass them up lightly without seeking God first. It's worth remembering what Jesus had to say on this subject. The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field. So I just want to leave you with the thought that as a church community, we will be at our most effective when, to quote the words of Bob the Builder, we are working together to get the job done. And hopefully we'll be having some fun at the same time. Amen.